Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the SOM TV podcast, where we talk about food, wine, spirits, beer, and we do it mostly hungover. I am the director of the films, Jason Wise, and the founder of SOM TV, which is a new streaming network coming up with all sorts of educational content, new shows, our home for our upcoming movies, all sorts of stuff, the loss of my sanity, everything. So go to SOMTV.com to sign up for updates. We'll be launching August 4th for our charter membership. Really looking forward to showing you that stuff. One of the major things I have thought about a lot since I made these first films is the concept of an influencer. And I don't mean these people who have 10,000 followers on Instagram who get paid to stand there and look pretty with a bottle of wine or food or whatever. I'm talking about actual influencers, people who just by doing anything move the needle in enormous amounts in a particular subject. And in wine, it's really fascinating because it's a hard subject to get a grasp on. And one of the things that's happened recently is the NBA getting deep into wine. So much so that they have begun to change the landscape of what people drink. So I sat down with a really talented sports writer to talk about the NBA's influx into wine and what its effects are going to be on all of us drinking. We are here at Aspen Food & Wine 2019. It is an endurance test. I'm with Baxter Holmes, who is...
a senior writer for ESPN who focuses on the NBA.
Right. And you cross paths with Food & Wine a lot. We are at Aspen Food & Wine Festival. How is your liver hanging up?
Oh, man. You know what? I feel okay today. It's Friday morning, and last night was, I guess, what, the intro night or something, whatever you want to call it?
I don't know. I feel like I've been here for 4 years.
Yeah, right. I can't even remember how many people told me this yesterday. We're at 8,500 feet elevation, drink a lot of water, and so I tried to drown myself yesterday in water. I feel okay today. I feel okay. Those might be famous last words. There's still like 2 days ahead.
You're doomed.
Yeah, I know. This is kind of like saying in the horror films where it's like, oh, I'll be right back. They're not coming back.
All right, you ready to talk NBA and food, wine?
Let's do it. I've been at ESPN for 4.5 years now. Focused on the NBA my first 3 years there. I was covering the Lakers. Before that, I was 2 years covering the Celtics for the Boston Globe. Before that, I was with the LA Times, I was a sports reporter. In my current role, I'm scouring the NBA for great features and in-depth stories, investigations, what have you. And in the window of the stories that I've told is, I don't know, maybe a half dozen to a dozen that involve food and wine. And that is, I imagine, why we're sitting down today.
Yeah, well, so when I read your story about NBA players getting into wine and the kind of budding obsession that exists there, I was frankly blown away, honestly. I mean, you know, I've made a few films in this space and I live in a very small world. And when I read that it's now reached kind of, I've always looked at professional athletes, especially in the NBA, as these kind of titans, you know, that I don't have a lot in common with. And so when I read this article, it really blew me away. It's also very well written, by the way. Good job.
Oh, well, I have very good editors. So, the story was a lot of fun. It started because I kept noticing that players were posting more about wine on social media and mentioning it like in post-game press conferences. And I was genuinely curious if they were genuinely curious about wine or if they were just spending money on wine. I mean, it's for people who have means to spend money on things that cost a lot of money is not, I don't think, interesting to anybody. But I was interested if they were generally wanting to learn and understand wine and maybe why that was. And around the time, you know, your films, I remember when I was interviewing Chris Paul and he brought up the film and he was asking me, he's like, he was talking about the MS exam, how brutal it was. He's like, oh, I couldn't even imagine that. So I think in some ways, players, they look at wine and everything that it takes to make it, the attention to detail, the precision, the coming from the earth, you know, growing something, making something, shaping it. And a lot of their game, them becoming players, is like all these unseen hours in the gym and fine-tuning all these details, these everything. So I think there's a mutual respect for like making something great, the craft of it. And I think there's also mutual respect in them for the elites. They're at the top 1% of their field, right? But I think they look at like Master Somms and the elite winemakers in that same way, just like these masters of this, you know, thing that is really popular, that a lot of people enjoy, just like, you know, a lot of people enjoy basketball, a lot of people enjoy sports, but these are like the top 1%. So I think there's a lot of mutual connections there. But yeah, to go back to your thing, I mean, you know, I spent, I don't know how many months on that story, and it was a lot of fun. It was very illuminating, and wine, you know, the NBA was a beer and liquor league for a long time. And then in the last decade or so, wine has basically kind of replaced that in a lot of ways. That's not to say the guys don't enjoy beer or, you know, whatever, but wine is the thing.
Well, let's take a step back. How did you get into wine yourself? Because you have to know there's not a lot of ability to bullshit your way through this world. I mean, you have to kind of, it's not a name drop situation, because you can know who name drops really quick and who actually knows and has been to places. And how did you get into wine?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that, you know, people have asked me, like, oh, you must have been into wine and say you did. I'm not really. I'm good at learning and admitting that I don't know things and being just like willing to ask people who know more than me very stupid, simple questions, a lot of them.
I can sympathize with that one.
Yeah, so right. I mean, yeah, you understand as well. That's a big part of your job. And I've, a lot of the same people that you've talked to, I have stolen ridiculous amounts of their time asking the most elementary questions about, you know, how do I describe this? How do I explain that? So it's been a crash course for me over a period of like 2 years as I've worked on, you know, two mainly in-depth stories that involve wine of learning about it. I mean, before that, like, I didn't really know anything. And I wasn't like a big wine connoisseur. I didn't have a lot of, I wouldn't even say I'm like a wine connoisseur now. But if I was to say that there was kind of a lightning, an aha moment, if you will, in wine talk, I was at a restaurant with my wife in Portland, Oregon, and we did the tasting menu, and they were like, you know, do you want to do the wine pairing? I'm like, sure. And the guy said, how heavy do you want me to go on, like, the descriptions of the wine? We're like, you know, as heavy as you want, whatever. And so he told a really great story about every bottle or about every glass that we had, where it was from, the people that made it, that region, what it's like, what that year was like, the family that made it, what their story was, and how it would pair well with every dish. And I'm obsessed with stories, obsessed. Like, that's my, if you're just say, like, what do you, you know, players are obsessed with wine or whatever, like, I'm obsessed with a good story. And just stories in general, the art of storytelling. And I remember thinking, like, man, wine is, it's like there's a good story in, like, every bottle, in a way, of a lot of things. People that made it that year, the, you know, on and on and on history. And that was kind of a moment for me when a light bulb ticked off about, like, the potential of story in wine. So that's, I would say that's how it kind of started. But, like, that, look, the stories, that's how I learned asking people a lot of questions. So
it's yeah. Good. No, that's I mean, it's the exact same path as me. I mean, I walked into this as a naked baby, you know, when it came to, and I made some, and it sort of, as I'm sure writing your articles have been similar, you the next level you go up, you realize, holy crap, I had no idea what I didn't know. And then the next level you go up, you go, and it's just a continuation of, I don't know shit.
It's kind of intimidating in a way, right? I mean, yeah. I felt that way. I remember I had a talk with my wife at one point before I embarked on one of these stories, and she was like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, wine is, you know, it's incredibly vast. The history dates back basically to the beginning of civilization. There's so much, you know, people, as you documented well, people spend their whole life in pursuit of this elite title of master sommelier, and that's just trying to learn everything that they can, and even they don't know everything.
And that's not even the making of it. I mean, those people,
right?
You know, sommeliers are the people who sort of intermediary bring it to you.
Yeah.
But the people that make it, that's a whole another thing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's daunting. It definitely was one of the more daunting subjects I ever approached, because look, it's putting it out in a mass, you know, as you know, putting it out to a mass audience. And if you don't know what you're talking about, like, you know, particularly the experts in that field, they'll be like, look, this is another wasted. And I remember the first, this is kind of like, this is a deep cut on the B-sides, I guess, but when the article came out, the NBA on Wine 1, I was really nervous because I was like, you know, there's probably some element that I screwed up, and wine people will be like, oh, this is, he got this terminology wrong, what a you know, rookie mistake or something like that. And I got a direct message from Eric Asimov of the New York Times, their wine critic. And he said something to the effect of, like, you know, I read a lot of wine stories and a lot of them sound the same. And, you know, some of them, especially for people who don't really know what they're doing. But this was really good. Even your description of this particular wine was, like, really on point. And I just wanted to say, like, you told a good story and you told it well and you told it right. And it was the first time I could breathe in a way, because I was just, like, so nervous up to that point of, like, oh man, I've probably screwed up somewhere. And
so you were more afraid of the wine response than the NBA response.
Yeah, I know how to tell a story about people in the NBA. I mean, that's my job. I've done that for a while. So I knew that I was going to represent a community. And well, I guess it's two communities, right? The NBA and wine. But I knew one well. You know, I live and breathe it. The other one I didn't. And so it was like jumping into this pool that I don't really know anything about. That is, you know, like I said, as you know, like complicated, and there's cachet in knowing things and knowing everything. And I was just like, man, I just don't want to look like an idiot.
Yeah.
So
I find the wine world to be a lot less snobby than people think.
I mean, you know
it's
what?
Not, and it's not like that.
And I learned this. Like one of the, a lot of master sommeliers and some super high-end winemakers that I completely bothered like to no end to learn were some of the most humble people I'd ever met. They would say things like, look, you know, and they could probably see the terror on my face or hear it in my voice. And they would say like, look, hey, don't sweat it, man. Like nobody knows everything. Wine is meant to be enjoyed. It's everybody's palate's different. Everybody's, you know, journey is different. It's not like there's these ultimate right and wrongs about everything. So just like, it's okay. You know, this is, it's a food thing and it's, it is what it is. So that helped like put me at ease a little bit, yeah. Ease the panic attacks.
All right, so in the panic attacks.
I'm just kidding.
No. So how did, let's get back to the NBA and how did you know something was exploding with wine? Because I mean, as a fan, you know, I'm from Cleveland, obviously. LeBron's from Cleveland. I've been rather obsessed with him and his career and all sorts of stuff, but from a lot of angles.
Yeah.
And when I found out I started filming for Somme 3 and then what we have coming up on Somme TV. And I seem to be following LeBron at all these wineries. You know, I'm up at Continuum, I'm up at Mayacamas, I'm filming. And they're like, LeBron James was here 3 days ago. Or LeBron James came here for his wife's birthday. And it was just this nonstop thing. And I'm like, I am following or two steps ahead of LeBron James. It's the weirdest thing. I've never had anything in common with this guy outside of being from Cleveland. It's a bizarre. How did you find out that the top echelon of the NBA was getting so into wine like this?
I remember seeing some pictures. It might have been like the Banana Boat picture of, the Banana Boat tasting group, as I came to call it.
So that would be Dwayne Wade,
Carmelo Anthony, Chris Paul, and LeBron James.
Okay.
And they were all toasting glasses of wine. I remember thinking like, you know, they could be toasting anything. But I remember it was when I connected with Chris Miller randomly. Through like two other people. He's a master sommelier.
Chris Miller, the master sommelier.
Yeah, and he told me, I was like, look, I'm kind of have this hunch that players are really into wine and that maybe there's something more there. You know, do you have any other thing? He was like, well, actually, you know, I went to dinner with Chris Paul and LeBron and I was blown away by their wine knowledge. And like, they were asking a lot of really interesting, smart questions. And I was like, and he was thinking like, these aren't the kind of questions that just anybody asks. Like they're really wanting to learn. And that was kind of an aha moment for me. I was like, I think there's something more there. And I remember, I would talk to people at wineries, you know, and you would, as you mentioned, like, and they would stop by and they'd be like, yeah, their questions were really good. They were really taking their time trying to, not just like just downing the wine, but trying to sip it, trying to understand it, smell it, and, you know, see what elements on the nose they could pick up. So they were genuinely like really trying to understand and learn, you know, like, oh, why was this vintage good? Or what's an iconic vintage for that? The other thing I would say is too, is this. So, you know, we'd mentioned like the Manwood crew. Those guys are huge. Like LeBron, when he does anything, it moves the needle in whatever direction. So he could be interested in, you know, sourdough bread. It will move the needle on sourdough bread. So when he's interested in wine, it's like the cultural needle shifts in that direction because of how big and famous he is, his following on social media, everything. Like just that guy can move the market. And then it helped that the other guys that he was and is, you know, kind of drinking with are huge names in their own right. So these are huge, huge stars. And I think from them and principally from LeBron, like he's impacted the NBA in enormous amount of ways and, you know, players feeling better about speaking out on social issues. Like there's a long list of it, but wine is certainly up there. And I think you could probably make the case that he's made wine more accessible or open to a much larger audience of people just in general.
Yeah, but the other thing is the wine he's drinking is $300 to $500 a bottle often. So yeah. there's this conundrum that I find with wine in that he's not starting where most of us start. He's starting with
Are you saying that he has means?
Is I'm
that
saying that. Yeah, I'm saying he certainly does. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just an observation. I mean, you know, you and I don't know where you started, but I started with very inexpensive wine. And then somebody gives you something that not necessarily was expensive, but was different. And you go, well, what is this? And you move up a ladder.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know where I started. Maybe the wine they give you on airplanes, whatever that is.
That's wine.
Yeah, it's fermented grape juice.
Yeah.
You're right in that, you know, some of the bottles he's posting are in a different tax bracket than the average consumer.
Right.
I remember talking to Kevin Love about this once, and he said, the forward for the Cavs, and he said, you know, we do take great joy in finding like a great $50 bottle. Obviously, they don't have to. They could spend, you know, if they wanted to drink just DRC every night, I think they probably could make that happen.
Right.
But I think that's a very humanizing thing in a way, because a lot of people, like, that's one of the great things about wine is, like, you know, you buy a bottle, you maybe not, you don't know much about it, but you're interested in it or somebody recommends it, it's $50, you try it, you're like, and you're just knocked on your socks. I mean, I remember when I had a moment like that once, and it was like my aha moment with wine. So there is some joy in that, but you're right. There's a little bit of a disconnect in terms of like what they can do.
I don't mean it's bad or good. It's just an observation.
No. It is an observation. I mean, but it's a real thing too. Like one of the more iconic photos was of Dwayne Wade and Jimmy Butler, I think, in Carmelo Anthony. I think they were in France. I can't remember if it was Burgundy or Bordeaux. And like the wines that were in front of them collectively would probably pay my rent for the year, maybe multiple years. So I'm like, well, you know, some of these, I don't know when I'll have it or if I'll ever have. But if anything, so as an outsider to like me, wine is this vast, complicated kind of behind the pearly gates kind of thing. It was like you can only enter if you know a great deal about wine and all of that. And it was like, and only people who know, you know, there's they get pins too. There's the only those people can be able to like drink great wine or know about wine or even enjoy wine casually. And the rest of you, it's just, you can have beer and, you know, tequila and whiskey or whatever. But I think that players have opened that door for public at large, just to not be maybe as intimidated and like, oh, it's cool for them, you know, maybe wine is a cool thing. And it's not just something that my grandparents had with dinner or something, that, you know, it's a cool thing to have. And it amplifies a meal and an experience. And by the way, that's like, that is so true around the world, like for the history of the world. But in America, we just, you know, been behind the times, I guess.
Yeah, we're still.
I'm putting it mildly.
Yeah, we're still behind the times.
Yeah.
And so when LeBron came on, I mean, I remember when he had that injury with the Lakers. Now, obviously.
Oh yeah.
And he comes walking on the court with a glass of wine.
Well, he entered the arena. He entered the arena. Yeah. That was a touchstone moment too, and we can debate whether or not that was a good thing, like a good look or a bad look. But nonetheless, he brought wine into an arena. And
let's debate that, because I mean, in America, you mean from an alcohol standpoint?
Yeah, look, I've heard some people say, and
Set up what happened.
He was injured, and he walked into an arena with a clear glass that had red wine in it. It was drinking wine, and I remember on social media, like, blew up and wine's everywhere, and it was another touchstone moment for wine. I mean, again, LeBron moves the needle in that way. Now, some people could say, well, is it a good look for an employee, any employee, to come into an office drinking alcohol? That's a question for another day. I don't really want to go down that rabbit hole. I heard some people in the wake of that.
All of my employees drink wine all day.
I know. Well, you run a wine, you know. It's a little bit different.
Yes.
You
know. Yes.
Anyways, that's a topic for another day.
Yeah.
But when I think of players and wine, here's the biggest thing that I take away from it. It is one of the few ways, and this is true of, I think, food in general, it is one of the few ways for us to relate to them, to connect with them. They're at the top 1% of what they do. They're incredibly wealthy, incredibly famous. They're incredibly big. They're, you know, these super-sized people. And so there's like the lanes in which we can communicate with them or understand them or connect with them are pretty slim. But food and wine are one of the most humanizing ways to connect anybody, whether it's athletes and the people who watch sports, different cultures. When people come to the table is when we're all just people and our backgrounds tend to fade. And we're just enjoying like our learning what's in front of us. And so that's been a takeaway for me in the two main stories I've done about food and wine and sports is, and the reaction to them is the human, is the way in which those, like food is one of the few things that unites us all. When we come to the table, we are all people, regardless of whether or not you're a documentarian or a writer or an NBA player or an NBA coach, you know, at the table, everyone is equal.
I think that is absolutely what wine's real purpose is, aside from if you have children, to get you a little drunk to deal with the children. Just want to interrupt for a quick second to say, please go to somtv.com, sign up for updates for our new streaming network. One thing we have coming that I am really proud of is all of the pretty footage we've shot around the world in the great wine regions. We are stringing that all together and making a series where it is just beautiful photography of places you want to be. So you can be in Alsace and you can be in the Northern Rhone and you can be in Italy and you can be in all these beautiful places. And this is something I've actually started using myself just to kind of calm down, which is something I need very often. All right, back to my conversation with Baxter Holmes.
So I
understand the whole Popovich thing, and I want to set up for me who Greg Popovich is and what he, I mean, he's a titan in the NBA as well.
Yeah, he's considered the greatest NBA, I think he has the most wins of any coach ever. He's considered the greatest coach of all time in the NBA. Maybe one could make the case in sport, period, in the history of sport. He's coached, you know, for like two decades in San Antonio. Every year they made the playoffs, five championships. It's been remarkable. And it's an organization that people, various businesses come to study because of the tight-knit chemistry, the connectedness, their continuity, their ability to be excellent every single year, even as certain players come and go. Books have been written about that organization from a leadership and managing people standpoint. It's a really remarkable thing. But, you know, I did a story. So let me backtrack a little bit. When I started on the first story about like wine in the NBA, every time I would even mention those things, wine, NBA, people would say, oh my God, Greg Popovich. I'm talking like winemakers, sommeliers, like wine collectors. And they would tell some legend about him. Like, oh, he came into the restaurant and the dinner was unbelievable. He ordered these wines. Like, I was blown away with his knowledge. He was like an MS on his own. Like, it was just incredible. And I kept hearing all these legends about him and these unbelievable dinners. And there were so many that I honestly set them aside. I was like, I just want to focus on players. So I did the player story. It came out in like February, I think it was 2017 or 18. And then I went back to the story on Popovich and I learned about the art of the team dinners. And he does these incredible, incredible dinners all throughout. And he has this for decades. Food's been a big part, even when he was a Division III basketball coach, of bringing people together. He's figured out that, you know, feeding people, showing care and love is a great balance to being kind of a really demanding, intense coach on the court. But he is obsessed with food and wine. He got into it 50 years ago. He has the impressions that he's made on a lot of people in the industry is mythical. He, at these dinners, like he coordinates all the wine. He'll bring wine from his cellars. He'll order, you know, 20,000. I mean, he drops so much money on wine.
So give me an example. Where do these dinners take place?
Oh, I mean, like Michelin star restaurant, like French Laundry per se. I mean, like, you know, Michelin star restaurants. And also just, you know, he scours, like anytime the best new restaurant lists come out, he's all over that. But he'll find, like I wrote about in the story on him, you know, hole in the wall restaurant in San Francisco, Seven Hills, Knob Hill. It's a small Italian spot. He loves it. And he made that like an NBA destination. And
so one minute you've got this place in Knob Hill, little Italian place. It's just a normal restaurant.
Yeah, it's a good Italian restaurant. Small, I think it's like 42 seats or something. And he scouts restaurants and like wine as meticulously as he does like opponents. And that may sound weird to say, but when he applies his mind to something, he has a brilliant mind. And when he applies it to something, if he wants to learn about politics or know about politics, which he does, he goes all in. If he wants to know about history of war or how this country, he goes all in. And when he applies it to food and wine, and which he's done for 50 years, and it's been a great balance to his intensity, he goes all in. So he scouts and he everything, the ambiance, the list, the sequencing of the dishes, how many people are gonna be at the table, Like these experiences are legendary. And I don't say that, like that's a big word, not to be taken lightly. They're legendary. And when he recommends a restaurant, it's the same as a Michelin star. It carries that much weight for people in the NBA, and probably because of his reputation even outside the NBA. I mean, he's the man when it comes to this stuff.
What are some of his favorite wines?
His favorite wine is, that's a great question. His favorite wine, number one, is, and help me on the pronunciation if I get this wrong. It's either, is it Chateau Yquem or Dequem?
Chateau Yquem.
Dequem? With
and
a D.
I'm probably, I guarantee, saying that wrong.
I've heard it so many different ways. The legendary.
We have something coming up on Somme TV where we filmed extensively at Chateau Yquem, so I feel half confident it's right.
All right, so I'm going to go with the D. Chateau Yquem, he loves. I mean, legendary Sauternes, French, you know, Thomas Jefferson was obsessed with it. One of the most legendary wines ever, as you know. But he's obsessed with it. That's number one. Number two, again, help me on the pronunciation. It's legendary, iconic Italian red, Musetto. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, it's close.
Loves it. That's his number two. And then number three, I'm going to tell you how I know these things. And then number three is 1970s Napa.
I love that.
Yeah. And that's when he fell in love with wine. He was, so his origin story, at the Air Force Academy, graduates, gets stationed in an Air Force base outside Napa in like 1970. And a year before, a friend of his who played at the Academy with him, graduated before him, was at Stanford Law. So they're both in the Bay Area. They have nothing to do and not a lot of money. So they went up to Napa, like in 1970, and around Napa, and we're going to wineries like Mayacamas and Stony Hill and Ridge, and drinking all day and eating for free and drinking for free and learning. And this is before the Judgment of Paris tasting. It's before Nixon brought Tromsberg over to China.
You know your stuff. It's good.
Oh, but it was like a magic. I mean, literally, in the history of wine in America, you probably couldn't pinpoint a better place to learn and fall in love with wine. And that's when he did. He loves going back to some of those wines. And lo and behold, some of those wines are like some of the greatest wines ever produced, not just in the history of Napa or whatever, but Napa 1970s, I mean, It's. I'm trying to do like a basketball analogy. But that's like the '96 Bulls. You know, it's not the night, or but like the mid '90s Bulls. Like they're legendary wines, legendary around the world. So, and look, Pop's had everything. You know, like he's not above. And I know that he did this, like going into Saison, being presented with the red book and the white book, pushing them both away, and just saying, "I want a vintage Latoche, and I don't care what it costs." He's not above that. But he loves. And gets a great thrill out of going back to that period when he first fell in love with wine and being blown away by some of those that have aged just beautifully, as you know.
That's so great. Yeah. That's really great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so people ask me, like, how did wine become popular in the NBA? Like, what was the origin story? It's complicated. I think he's played a role. I think guys getting closer, certain huge names getting closer to 30 have played a role. I think as guys have gotten more interested in post-career investments and they're spending time in the Silicon Valley Bay Area and wine is big there and that's what's on the table, I think that's part of it. And
so NBA players are investing in wineries. I know Yao Ming has a winery.
Yeah, Dwayne Wade, who's here in Aspen, partners with Paul Meyer. He does it. And there's cachet in for players and I think for people. Players are people. In being able to look at a wine list and like, oh, you know, that would go great for this, or that's a great deal, or oh, that's a great year, or that's a really cool wine, we should have that. There's cachet in being able to read and understand a wine list, I think. And I think players see that and appreciate it. And there's cachet in having their name on a label. And I think they appreciate too. It's like, the wine's gotta be good. I can't just slap my name on a label, produce a bunch of cases, and then try to ride the celebrity of my name. So they are getting invested in it. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know the specifics of like LeBron's, what his pursuits are. They are varied, obviously involving a lot of Hollywood. But I wouldn't be surprised if he becomes, either buys a winery or becomes invests in one or, you know, makes his own label at some point.
I've heard more than a few investors say wine is not a good thing to invest in.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's just a very, it's a variable, it's a crop, you know?
Look, it seems so, every time when if I'm in Napa or if I'm talking to winemaker, it seems so difficult. I mean, you are at the mercy of nature and the weather. A million things can go wrong. You have control over like very little. And when the grapes come in, that's what you got to work with. And like, you know, what do you do? So it just seems like such a brutal.
In a way though, there's some sports analogies to the way wine works. And sure. You know, I mean, we're at Aspen Food and Wine right now and the NBA Finals ended last night and Klay Thompson went out with a torn ACL, and that can happen. It's a very similar thing to
right.
Everything's right, and then it's not.
And then, yeah, you know, right before harvest, fires break out.
Exactly.
In 2017. So,
exactly.
In Napa. So, yes, there are.
So I do think athletes could probably understand the fact that your body ages, you got to keep your mind sharp, you know, things change.
And the things
there's
happen.
An analogy with
yeah, there's things that can happen. They can come out of nowhere and can completely screw up everything. But, yeah, and to go back to that, I think, you know, if there was a time when players were not really, like, they weren't really focused on investing in things after their career until after their career. That's changed, and they're doing a lot more of it now. And I think wine plays into that. But it'll be interesting. I'm not sure how many are going to be as passionate as Dwayne and, like, try to go full bore into it. But we'll see. I mean, they're great ambassadors for wine and making wine more approachable in a way. Yes, they're you know, sometimes when they'll do the wine lineups, and you'll look and it's like, well, that's enough to pay, you know, a down payment on a house or something.
Yeah, $10,000 bottles and $20,000 bottles. I mean, I've seen it.
I'll say this though, man, like those guys, you know, I've had people ask me like, oh, who knows the most about wine in the NBA? It's Pop. It's Pop, and I don't know that it's necessarily close. And look, he has decades on these guys of experience. I remember one of the favorite things, this wasn't in the story, it was one of my favorite things about him was his want to learn. Like, as much as he knows, he will still go into a restaurant or a wine bar and will see something on the list. And you know, it might be somebody who at a restaurant was telling me this, like, that might be kind of window dressing. Like, we know nobody's going to order it, but it's a cool thing for us to have. And we think it's interesting, but he'll order that stuff. He'll order a bottle for himself. He'll order a bottle for the staff. He'll try it. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not. Like, he'll give it to the person sitting next to them. But his constant drive to learn is incredible. And that extends to everything. I mean, he's just got an amazing mind.
I mean, I think it's fantastic that NBA players are into wine. I mean, I have spent a lot of time as an outsider trying to show that wine is complicated, accessible, and
no, your films have
humorous.
Played a huge part. Not to praise you too much,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I did learn in my initial days of just trying to understand some basics about wine, you know, your documentaries were things that I watched over and over.
And I'm truly sorry.
Yeah. You owe me a lot for. Can I get those hours back?
I stole a lot of your time. No,
yeah.
No, you can't.
No.
I can't get those hours back.
No, I was just like, oh, well, this is so it's fermented. That's how this. Oh, okay. Well, and you know. But anyways, no, those are really helpful, and I think help open the door. So, and here's my segue. People will say, you know, what was the starting point? I think there's a lot of things that have happened. You know, I think that your documentaries play a part in making wine more accessible to a lot of people, not so daunting and intimidating. A social media, like Instagram, has made wine cool in a way, and people can keep score, so to speak. Although, I mean, we could debate whether that's a good thing or not. But there's a lot of things. But like the NBA, the popularity of it is incredible. We see it at ESPN, the numbers, the ratings, the social engagement, not just domestically, but globally. It's incredible. I remember a term an executive said at our shop. He was like, the NBA is ascendant. It is so popular around the world. And so anything that these guys are interested in, they raise the profile of it because of who they are and how popular the league is. And, you know, when teams are going up to the Bay Area to play the Warriors, if they have an off day, they're going to Napa or Sonoma. Players are taking trips to wine country, overseas, Italy, you know, all over France. So I'm interested to see where it goes. But it's been a really fun journey for me. I mean, I've written about a lot of things, and I don't know if I've had the experiences that I've had or met the kind of people I've met, or look where I'm sitting right now, you know. I don't know, I can't think of anything else that would have led me down this path and like led me to the people I've met and the things I've seen and whatnot and the experiences I've had other than wine. So I'm That's deeply great. Appreciative of all that.
Would you ever consider leaving sports and just writing about food and wine?
That is a very interesting question. I don't know. I mean, so here's a better way of looking at your question. It's the classic, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I understand the point of that question. It's, you know, like to get people to think about your goals and where do you see yourself. And maybe because I've worked at newspapers during periods of layoffs and when I was at the LA Times, bankruptcy the whole time. When I was at the Boston Globe, and there were like four big layoffs or whatever, rounds of layoffs. When I was at the Boston Globe, there was a sale, more buyouts. ESPN has certainly had their share of layoffs, and a lot of them have been played out very publicly. I think I've always just been focused on the story in front of me, a lot of which are very in-depth and ambitious and tricky. So I haven't really thought too far ahead. I'm always just focused on like, what's a great story? There are amazing stories in food and wine. And I've learned that so much over the last 2 years. And there's plenty that I've wanted to write that aren't really even tied to sports at all. I'm just like, wow, that's a great human story. Like there's so many to be told there. Could I see something happening down the road? I mean, I think I'm compelled enough and believe that there's enough good stories there that it could be something, but ESPN takes very good care of me. I'm certainly happy in what I do. And, you know, these are two of the biggest things that unite everybody. It's sport. I mean, like, look, go to a bar, game is on, the backgrounds of everybody who's in there, doesn't really matter. Everybody's just watching a game. Same way, like at a wine dinner. I remember I was at a wine dinner. The guy next to me, LAPD homicide detective, the woman across from me controlled like a robot on Mars, like one of the, I don't know if it was the rover or something, from like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I was just like, man, like everybody's backgrounds. So I say that to say that like sports and food and wine are so humanizing, and I think there's amazing stories in both of them. And that's what I care about most. So I hope that doesn't sound like I'm dodging your question.
No. I ask because it's, as a person who makes films, I am now known for, I have made 3 wine films, so I guess I'm guilty of this by my own attrition.
Yeah.
But I'm now known as this, I only make wine films, when that's not true. I've made a film about an actress. I have a film about sea urchin divers coming out. But it's how it goes, you know? And so it's, you kind of...
So this is an interesting thing.
That's why I ask.
No, it's an interesting thing. And I want to talk about this for a second because I don't know how many stories I've written, but a very small percentage, maybe like 6 or 8, have been about food and wine. But those have, for whatever reason, taken off in such a way that people have said, like, you know, that I'm a food writer who works for ESPN or something like that. And it's been interesting because part of me is like, well, I just care about like what a good story is. And I just think there happened to have been a lot of really good untold stories there. And I'm always trying to look where others are not because I think, you know, I obviously want to tell something that hasn't been told. You know, if some people look at me like, oh, he's a food writer or something like that, it's like, I'm looking for a great story. But I understand what you mean as kind of being pegged. People look at, you know, you've done a lot of work and they'll look at the Somme films and think like, oh, you're a wine documentarian.
Which I wear happily.
Yeah, and like, I don't mind if anytime somebody says like, I read the wine story or I read the Popovich story and I really enjoy them, that means the world to me. I don't take for granted that these are long stories and that people's attention, I mean, you know this with a documentary, like people's attention is a really fragile thing. You can lose it at any moment. And to be able to ask them to give you...
I'm hoping my mother is still listening to this at this point, yeah. By the way, anyway.
It is. Somebody told me that once about writing, that the most fragile thing is the reader's attention. You can lose it at any moment. Do not take that for granted. You have to earn it with every single word and every single sentence. They need to be compelling. You need to be able to hold on to the reader's attention. And it's been true of any medium. It can be music, it can be film, whatever. So I don't take for granted that in an era of dwindling attention spans, you know, if someone's willing to commit 20, 30 minutes to a story that I spent, you know, 5 months on and did 50 interviews for and, you know, it consumed my life in like a really aggressive way, I'm really appreciative of that. And if they have anything nice to say about the food and wine stories I've done, that's great. I'm happy to talk about that stuff all day. I certainly think I put that level of effort into everything that I do, whether it's an investigative story, if it's a sports science story. If, you know, I know that wine is one of the things that connects a lot of people, and that's it's certainly been reinforced to me time and again through this. I mean, you've probably seen that, I'm sure, with your films, like how they've the impact they've made, the people they've reached. All of it, for sure.
This is the most fun thing I've ever could imagine doing.
Yeah.
I adore it. I never really look at any of these movies as about wine, though.
Yeah.
Because in the end, sports is a little different in the fact that sports, there is a natural story. There's a winner and a loser. But sports is also about 50 other things always.
Oh,
you know, you have people coming from backgrounds that are really challenging. You have people who have just wanted to see their team win before they die. You've got all sorts of stuff. And as a Clevelander, I can tell you that's how I feel.
Yeah, there's a million stories.
But wine is literally just a bunch of stories in a bottle. I mean, it literally is.
It's what we were talking about at the beginning. Yeah. It's like, it's you know, it's that place, it's that year, it's the people that made it, it's...
And that's why I can't seem to leave this world, because every single time I think I've reached some form of an end, all it does is just open up a bigger door to more things that I didn't know I didn't know. And it just goes and goes and goes.
It does. I mean, it does go down the rabbit hole. And I've been, you know, I live in Los Angeles. I've been really fortunate to connect with a community of people there who've, their generosity, like a lot of people in the wine community, is just astounding. And I've learned a lot from them. And learning, like trying different wines, learning more about that region, that history, that producer, certain, it is really interesting. And I think, I've also come to think about this, like, you know, so a lot of the reporting and writing I do is pretty intense, in that, like, I'm probably maniacal with respect to, like, how much I'm going to give myself to that story, and just consumes my life, and I'm not really a person while I'm working on it. But I remember when I was reading, or when I was doing a lot of the reporting on Popovich about how, like, he's that way with basketball for sure, but that his college coach told me that he was glad that he came into Food and Wine when he did, because he thought that he needed something else in his life that would help balance it out. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people, people can find all kinds of things in their lives that can give them some measure of balance. And I will say that I think learning about food and wine and what it takes to produce something special, the attention to detail, the craft, the hunt for great ingredients. Actually, on that note, I'll say this. I speak to college classes sometimes about, like, journalism and writing and whatnot, and I use a food analogy all the time to explain great stories. And the analogy is this. Let's say you're the greatest chef in the world, but you have terrible ingredients, just terrible. It's going to be really hard for you, Jason, to make a good meal out of that. You can dress it up as much as you want, but the ingredients are bad. Now me, let's say I'm not even a chef, but I'm a reasonable cook. I don't burn the kitchen down and I can follow a recipe, but I am just like maniacal in my hunt for great ingredients. The freshest this, the hardest to get that. I'm gonna get, you know, these fruits and vegetables from this producer, or this meat from this whatever. If I get that and I have all these amazing ingredients, and I can follow a recipe, I'm gonna make a meal that will be your meal 10 times out of 10, 100 times out of 100. And the analogy I say with that to students is, it's all in stories, it's all about the reporting and the information you gather, the ingredients you gather. And if you have a great story, if you devote yourself in gathering information, the art of reporting, you will have rich material that you can tell a great story with. Doesn't matter, you don't have to be the greatest writer ever. And I think great stories is like 95% reporting. And if you can follow that, hopefully I think you'll have a paycheck.
That's great.
Yeah. So, but anyway, yeah. So I think a lot of things can be explained through food, you know, so. But that's one I use.
Even sports.
Yes. There's been some fun ones there. That's for sure.
That's
but the
good.
Popovich one was, man, that was so much fun. I mean, I kind of, when that one was published, I was happy that it was out there and the response was cool. But I also realized I was going to miss it because that was as much fun. You're talking about having fun. The places you've been, the people you've met, the things you've seen are incredible.
I've been very lucky.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember when I was doing that story, like, for the amount of time I was doing it, for the people I would talk to, for the legends they'd hear, like hearing a restaurant owner tell like some incredible story and how much fun it was. I was like, man, I'm going to miss that. Like, that was a lot of fun. So anyways.
I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, man.
I'm glad to do it.
Thanks, everybody, for being here for our second episode. Next week, I have Master Sommelier Jay Fletcher. Let me tell you something about Jay. He is the guy in the first film who passes Dustin, and they both kind of cry and do this whole thing. But what we don't get into in the film is this man's incredible story as a pool hustler. He might be one of the most unique people at the top of the food and beverage world. He started as a pool hustler in Madison, Wisconsin, and traveled the entire country. And his stories, you will not believe how this man got from there to being one of the top master sommeliers in the country. He's a good friend of mine, but our relationship did not start that way. It was very rocky. So I think you're going to want to tune in. That's going to be coming next week. Thank you all so much for making this podcast blow up. And please, please remember, subscribe, rate us. See you next week.